This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Back in 2012, I had the privilege of moderating my first panel discussion when I participated in the C.S. Lewis Foundation retreat for that year, which was held in Texas. As noted with a few other podcasts, since moving where my audio files are hosted, I hadn't shared this show since then. The theme of the retreat related to The Great Divorce, one of Lewis's fictional works, but a variety of questions were fielded by the panel.
And this is the second and final part from the 2012 C.S. Lewis retreat. If you haven't already, be sure to listen to the first part.
Guests are Joseph Pierce, Lou Marcos, Diana Glier, Andrew Lazo, and Doug Jackson.
We join in now where the previous one left off.
My question is not nearly so elevated. We know many of the people that influenced Lewis, like Dante or Tolkien or the authors he liked. But I wonder about two particular ones that I don't know whether he ever said anything about. And one of them is Dostoevsky, and the other is Christopher Smart.
We don't know the answer, but he knows someone that does.
Go ahead.
Don't ever hear me argue about how good the good old days were. Having iBooks and having the collected letters on my iPad, I can definitively tell you that at least in volume three of the letters, he never referred to Christopher Smart. Well, I have to spell in order to do that.
That's true. There's some variant spellings in there. This could take some time.
I'm going to have to take off my shoes for this. D-O-S-T-O-Y?
But it's spelled different ways. You probably have to try different things. It's spelled different ways.
There's a wonderful out-of-print resource I'll reference, the C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia. Or let's get back to that question, maybe. Or do you have anything? It's fine.
Generally, my answer
Which one of those two, Dostoevsky or Christopher Smart, is your idol, as a matter of interest? So I'm working on the pun. It's an idle question.
Very punny.
In general, the answer, did Lewis read X, Y, and Z? In general, the answer is probably so. I mean, he had read most everything. There were certainly some gaps. I don't find anything under Fyodor or Dostoevsky for Volume 3 of the letters. But the indices of Volumes 1 and 2, and I don't think Becca has sold the Volumes 1 and 2 yet, they're still there. I would absolutely. Those letters are so carefully. But Becky has it. Becky? Oh, I'm looking in the letters, not online. But there's nothing more embarrassing to my high school students than to watch adults play with technology.
I'll say this. Lewis is readable, and his character's actions are rationally motivated, so I don't think he was influenced by Dostoevsky.
He did read it. I'm cheating too here. Now the C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia, and it says from the start, Lewis writes about the books he is reading, and it gives a long list. And is listed. And I'm trying to see if there is but there's no separate entry, so a direct influence is not maybe as great. Or
does it say which of his books he was reading?
It's just listing some of the different ones, like Aristotle, Austin, Boswell, Blake, Bunyan, and so forth.
Mary Mueller rightly points out that one of the great treasures of our time, aside from Joel Heck and the members of this panel, is the Wade Center, the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College. I heartily encourage you to support them, to go to visit them. They have Lewis's wardrobe that was in his home as a child. They've got Tolkien's writing desk, but far more importantly, they've got unpublished manuscripts. They've got all the letters. They've got the Lewis family papers. They've got Warney's unabridged diaries. It is a wealth of resources, and they've got a fantastic reading room where you can go. And two of the most able and knowledgeable archivists who know more about Lewis when they sneeze than I've ever learned in my life. And then maybe you get a chance to have lunch with Chris Mitchell or Jerry Root or Marge Mead. I mean, the Wade Center has got, and they've got 2,500 volumes of Lewis's own books with annotations in them. I've got a poem that Lewis jotted down in one of his books on Wordsworth that's never been transcribed. And online, they've got an increasing number of resources, including a listing of his library and which books were signed and or annotated by him. So Wade Center, you know, the Maryne Wade Center, wheaton.edu will get you there.
Could I ask just kind of a related question to what you were saying, and it just made me think of it. I like the question, even though we didn't get as much of an answer as we did. What American authors did he admire? Did he follow? Did he maybe even dislike? What did he think of just American literature, or you can broaden that to say, what did he think of the United States of America, period? I've kind of always wondered the story how the Wade Center came into possession. I mean, how did that happen? And that must have something to do with someone's respect across the pond for him.
Professor Clyde Kilby interacted with Lewis and with Tolkien, helped him complete the Silmarillion, and just became invested in these authors and began buying everything that he could, eventually buying the library. I'll say this and then shut up for my betters. I've read his copy of The Scarlet Letter, and at the very end, Lewis writes, "Finished a second time in 1956. I'd forgotten how terribly bad the writing is in places. Oh. Never again."
Well, I'll tell you something that might shock you, that this is a little off tangent, but we all love G.K. Chesterton. And I'm a British guy. I don't do American. But I'd read a few poems by Walt Whitman, but it's like, I don't want to read Whitman. Give me a break. And then I was reading G.K. Chesterton, and Chesterton said, this is what Chesterton said, it kind of shocked me. He said, if you say you don't like Walt Whitman and you've never read him, you can be forgiven. But if you've read him and you still say you don't like him, you can't be forgiven. So I went and read through one, and it was actually better than I expected it to be. But I remember that, but I don't remember Lewis saying anything about Whitman. Do you remember?
He tended
to avoid. I'm going to take this tangent a bit further. We turn to C.S. Lewis in a moment. I think the thing with Chesterton and Chesterton's like of Whitman, Whitman was very, very important to Chesterton, overcoming the almost suicidal, decadent-driven pessimism that Chesterton experienced as an undergraduate at the Slade School of Art. And reading Whitman was an antidote to the poison of pessimism. And it was Whitman's optimism. Yeah. So I think that Chesterton kept a soft spot for Whitman in his heart. But I'd be interested to know when he wrote those words, because I think that he modified his view on Whitman. In other words, wasn't quite so glowing later in life.
You know what? I'm pretty sure it's in his book on Robert Browning.
Which was an early book.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a Browning.
Yeah, so in his early days, he would have been very pro-Whitman.
Oh,
I think if
he was surprised.
Wrote a book in the 20s or 30s, it had been somewhat toned down.
Okay.
Just a very short answer to your question, perhaps a bit more directly. Lewis didn't prefer a lot of American authors, but it's, I think, difficult to put that as a geographic observation. I think it's primarily about age. He preferred older books, and America simply isn't old enough to have produced very many very ancient epics.
But he read a ton, and he read very, very widely. And Joel calculated that he read an entire book every 2 days at his height. You know, it's just like chunking paperbacks into a big bonfire or a big garbage can. He just was constantly reading and reading everything. So it's... You assume that he didn't read it at your peril. So.
I don't know. There's a story of Tolkien being caught. You know, you hear sort of stories about teenage boys being caught red-handed with pornography and sort of throwing it under the bed. But Tolkien apparently was caught red-handed reading some pulp fiction and threw it under the bed before people noticed. But the reason I mention that is actually that at the beginning of The Great Divorce, he says that the idea came to him from a science fiction book that he wrote. And I think that Lewis probably did read quite a lot of what we might call pulp science fiction. But, you know, when he's writing, he's being serious, he's probably not going to spend too much time listing these sort of
should we say, lesser works. But I suspect he read quite a lot of American science fiction.
He read a huge amount. There were lots of magazines that he read. And he, one of the things I make every one of my students memorize till they can repeat it is from The Four Loves. The challenge of the critical mind, Lewis says, is not to praise or dispraise, but to define and describe. Not a good book or a bad book. Not the book is better than the movie. What do you mean by better? Better in what way? And Lewis also said he'd never read more than a page and a half of a book he didn't enjoy, and he read some very dull books. Have you ever tried to follow up on anything in Surprise by Joy? And so Lewis was an incredibly muscular reader who could find enjoyment. He'll say, this is a terribly dull book, but on page 32, there's a bit of dialogue that is just perfect, and the description of the pasture in chapter 39, you know, I've never heard better. And so he reads on such a multiple level, and I think he encourages me as a reader to widen my appetite and not to be so picky about things. And I think that he calls us to keep reading and read more. And the more that you read, the more muscular that you get, and you develop a strength of reading.
I would encourage you, if you haven't read his book of literary criticism, An Experiment in Criticism, just for a wonderful approach, a wonderful discussion of the philosophy of reading, as well as practical approaches or tips or ideas on how to read. It really is a lovely thing. And so much of that, he puts the emphasis on the reader and the reader's mind and state of mind as they encounter a text, and he himself modeled that very well. Experiment in Criticism is really worth your time.
And for those who are maybe like myself, who don't come from that literary type background or appreciation, who might find something like that boring, it is a very short book, and I did find it very enjoyable, again, not coming from that background. So,
and he says that these books provide for us who love reading a sort of iconography by which we sum up or interpret our existence. It provides us a code by which we live our lives. I have a friend who's never picked a place to live unless she thought that she could get into Narnia from some corner of her apartment. And isn't Aslan a powerful metaphor, or Edmund or Eustace? I mean, a sort of iconography by which we sum up or interpret our existence. Yes, I heartily recommend.
One other thing, I know there's a writer's track as part of this retreat. And one piece of priceless advice connected to all of this is ultimately, obviously, you have to have the talent, but you write as well as you read. So if you only read junk, you won't be able to write well. You know, read well in order to write well.
I have another question, yes.
Yes. I was wondering, as I'm pondering C.S. Lewis and for doctoral work, can anyone speak to his childhood love of Nordic or Norse mythology, and how he said, I read in one of the biographies by Walter Hooper that the problem with Christianity is they don't have a good amount of good myths. And so can someone speak to the impact of Nordic mythology on his writing?
Are we ready to skip dinner? I think there's a lot to talk about on this.
We have flights tomorrow.
Who wants to start?
Tolkien, Tolkien said that the reason that he wrote The Lord of the Rings was to write a mythology for England, because he said that the English do not have their own mythology. The Norse had their own mythology. The Germans had their own mythology. The Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, but the English didn't. So he wrote his mythology to give England its own mythology. That it's ultimately about story being good, about pictures being good, the North being somewhere which inspired both Tolkien and Lewis. It was the thing that brought both of them together, of course, in the first place. You know, Tolkien was a Catholic, Lewis was an anti-Catholic atheist. They had nothing in common except Norse mythology. So the power of the beauty of those myths to bring those two disparate individuals with different philosophies together was the beginning of it. And I remember Tolkien wrote a letter in which he talks about that ignoramus Adolf Hitler, who has destroyed all good things northern. Mm-hmm. No, because, of course, Hitler takes the northern thing and does horrible things with it, largely thanks to Nietzsche. To a lesser extent Wagner. But I think the whole point about these is this cauldron of story is it's inspirational, and it's meant to allow us to take it as a launching pad for our own creativity. And that's what they did. I mean, there's lots of ingredients of Narnia, lots of ingredients of Middle Earth that are plucked from those older myths, and particularly the Norse myths. So, you know, you can't really understand what Tolkien and Lewis are doing if you leave the Norse dimension out of it. It's probably the, you know, under Christianity, of course, which is the prevailing myth. But, of course, Tolkien and Lewis use the word myth as meaning story, not lie. One thing we have to get very, very clear. Yeah. So the Christianity, the true myth, the true story, of course, that's the most important ingredient in their work. But under that, you know, the Norse mythological ingredient is probably the most important.
I think, though, go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, to turn the question around just a little bit, we do need to remember, too, that the lack of mythic grandeur, particularly in the Gospels, becomes a part of Lewis's apologetic. It's what we would expect if the Gospel writers were recording what happened rather than telling a great saga. Lewis is tracking with Augustine at that point. Augustine, who was you know, a student of the great classical literature of his day, reads the New Testament and finds it very disappointing because of a lack of literary quality and those kinds of things. So, everything you say is right, but to flip that around, there was a sense in which the lack of mythic grandeur for Lewis spoke to the historical validity of the New Testament documents.
A fruitful area of graduate research is the Coalbiter Society. As far as I know, there have only been a couple of things published on the Coalbiters, and I did it, which is silly because I just poked around in the literature and there's a lot more to do. It's a group of friends who, in some ways, formed the basis of friendship, this kind of shoulder-to-shoulder basis of friendship between Lewis and Tolkien, and allowed them to have the intimacy for, as Diana has so clearly pointed out, for Tolkien to offer a poem to Lewis. That intimacy had developed around their friendship over Norse myth. Lewis wanted to smack Tolkien the day that he met him. He said so in his diary. Before long, though, they're the fastest of friends, and there's an interesting dynamic happening in this society where they read Old Norse. There's a draft of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where he talks about Yggdrasil, the one world ash, the world ash tree, and that gets deleted. Fenris Ulf is now, his name is changed to Maugrim, this good Latinate, you know, Mau, this grim mouth, this, I'm sorry, it's Anglo-Saxon, but Fenris Ulf is a character from Norse myth, Fenris Wolf, and of course if you read Snorri's list of elves, you find Gandalf in there, and so you can't possibly overestimate. There's been a lot of work done, so you'll have some LexisNexis work to do, but there's still plenty of work to be done in that area.
Like you said, there's so much. I'll throw a few things out. First of all, you probably know in Surprised by Joy, we talk about Lewis's early experiences of joy. And the one that everybody knows is Warney's Toy Garden. But just as important was, Lewis said he was young and he saw the book open and saw the words, "I heard a voice that cried, Bold the Beautiful is dead," and he said it carried him away. He called it northernness. He yearned for the north. His friendship with Arthur Greaves, who was his lifelong friend, you probably know that, began when they both realized that they loved Norse mythology. Also, you've got to find what Andrew just told you. If you can find the American editions of the Chronicles of Narnia, by Collier Press, it's about 1970. If you get that copy, it does say Fenris Ulf in there, and it also says the ash tree, and then they got rid of it. So he wanted to put that in. The other one that's very important is, of course, you know, his essay, Myth Became Fact, in God and the Dock, where, you know, again, Christ is the myth that was made fact, but he's got a very important line there where he says that Christ is more than Baldur, but not less. And what he meant by that, it's interesting that, you know, for that phrase, he doesn't mention Osiris or Adonis or Bacchus. He jumps in right away on Baldur. But what he means by that is that Christ is more than Baldur because he's historical, literal, real. But he's not less than Baldur. In other words, the mythic power is there. I mean, you're right that he didn't see it in the Gospels, but that he's not less than Baldur. He's got all of the beauty that appeals to the imagination, but he's also true.
Well, and Loki Bound. You know, he's doing Prometheus Bound, but with Loki from Norse myth. I mean, there's plenty of work to be done, and we'll be cheering you on.
Yeah, so one other thought on that, of course, is that from what Lou Marcus has just said, is that what Christianity does is to not dispense with the old myth any more than it dispenses with the old law. It doesn't come to dispense with the old law, the old myths. It comes to fulfill them. Mm. In other words, the Christian story is the fulfillment of all the mythological stories, the one that makes sense of them, the key that unlocks them, the thing that brings them to their fullness and their ripeness.
And that points to one of the fundamental moves of the Inklings is not to innovate, to make it new, like Eliot said, but to renovate, to renew. The one book of Lewis's scholarship that is not in print is Rehabilitations. And so have a look at the rehabilitative effort of Lewis and Tolkien to restore these myths that had been popularized in the 1900s and then totally taken on a runaway train by the modernists. And that's why Lewis's last, best, most culminative work is Till We Have Faces, A Myth Retold. It's a rehabilitative effort. And it harkens back to Tolkien and the TCBS. I mean, in 1916 or so, he's saying that our job is to kindle a new light in the world, or what is much the same, to rekindle an old one. It's a rehabilitative effort and an effort of restoration.
You know, two things here. I can't remember who said it. It might have been Mark Twain, but I could be wrong, that said that bad writers borrow, good writers steal. Is that Twain?
I've heard a lot of different.
Okay. So that's the first thing. And the other thing we need to remember is the only original thing is sin.
All right.
Oh, by the way, if you want a great Christmas gift, some of you probably know that when Lewis was a boy, he said he never coveted a book more than Arthur Rackham's drawings of the Ring Cycle.
Yes.
And if you go to Dover Press, you can buy a beautiful facsimile edition of all of those for about $16. Probably would have cost Lewis $100. And I got that for Alex when he was a kid, even though it had some little naked ladies, you know, there. I got it past my wife. But the... and you should also know that I think it's either next year or maybe it's 2014, the entire Ring Cycle is coming to Houston.
Oh.
I think it's 2014. The entire Ring Cycle is going to be performed. So
great.
Okay. Time-wise, if there's one short question out
It's not
there.
The questions that are a problem.
It's
my answer.
There's a question that we think they're answer shortly. I've got one that we can maybe let a few answer briefly in terms of the rehabilitations that reminded me of a question I had here. And that is, what was the best idea or concept that Lewis either created or adapted? There are many things that phrases or of sorts that I can think of, but I didn't know what comes to mind that stands out. Maybe a great...
Well, I guess because I'm an English professor, I think that Lewis, in one phrase, described the entire problem with modern academia, and I'm serious about that, and it's in Screwtape Letters, and it's the phrase, the historical point of view. And when I explain this to you, this is not only the problem with academia, it's the problem with academic conferences, and why I very rarely speak at them, because I hate them. I prefer this. Not that this is an academic, but you understand what I mean. Lewis says the historical point of view works this way, that when a modern scholar considers a classic work, Dante's Divine Comedy, whatever it is, the scholar will ask a whole series of questions. When was it written? What part of the career of the poet was it written? What influence, etc., etc., etc. There's only one question that will never be asked, and the question is it true? Is what Dante wrote in the Divine Comedy true? And I really think Lewis has put his finger, has diagnosed the main problem with academia, is even when we read the great books, we no longer go to them as a source of wisdom to understand virtue, even as a place to understand vice, so we avoid it and go to virtue. And you know, one thing I try to do in my university and many universities is try to get back to actually learning from Shakespeare, Dante, Milton, etc.
Let me end with this. Their hearts leaped, and a wild hope rose within them. There was a railway accident, said Aslan softly. Your father and mother and all of you are, as you used to call it, in the Shadowlands, dead. The term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is the morning. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories, and we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before.
Amen. Thank you, panel. Thanks for listening to this two-part podcast featuring the panel discussion from the 2012 C.S. Lewis Foundation Retreat. If you haven't already, be sure to listen to the first part. I'm William O'Flaherty, and this is All About Jack, which is a feature of my EssentialCSLewis.com website. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. When you check the show notes, you will find links to websites or blogs of those who participated in the panel discussion, and also, if relevant, a link to a recent podcast where they were a guest on my show. The show notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, highlights the most recent show on the main page and also has space dedicated to listing past shows and the notes for them. Additionally, you can find a variety of other material on Lewis there, including a popular series that explores quotations attributed to him that may not be actually from him. Be sure to stop by my site to listen to other interviews and special podcasts on a variety of topics, mostly directly related to Lewis. In 2016, I shared an interview I did with Walter Hooper from when I made my first trip to England. Also be aware that I occasionally post previous released podcasts on my iTunes feed that can also be found at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. And if you do visit me via iTunes, please consider rating my podcast as this can help others to find it. Finally, let me remind you, or in case you didn't know, I have a book out called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It's available online at Amazon. The paperback is $14.99, and at last check, the Kindle version was just $5.49. Buying the book is a great way to help support my podcast. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Thanks again for listening to the All About Jack podcast.